This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
Greetings, I am Barry. If you're searching for answers, spiritual help, clairvoyant readings, healings, crystals, books, incense, or jewellery, you need to go to Infinity, Hamilton Spiritual Centre, in the new premises at 550 Anglesey Street. Or you can phone us on 838 1838. This is your link between this life and the next. Become the change the world needs today. Can you hear the voice within? Can you hear me running? Can you hear me running? Can you hear me calling you? Can you hear the voice within? Can you hear me running? Can you hear me running? Can you hear me calling you?
The Voice Within, your connection between this world and the next. Brought to you by Infinity Spiritual Centre, 550 Anglesey Street, Hamilton.
Greetings, I am Barry. Now again this week we continue with our story of Michel Demarquet and his abduction to the ninth planet.
The first man on Earth. Once comfortably re-established in the Halley's, the relaxation room previously described, Thou began her strange recital. Michel, 1,350,000 years ago precisely, on the planet Bacaratini of the constellation Centaur. A decision was made by the leaders of that planet, following numerous conferences and reconnaissance expeditions, to send inhabited vessels to the planets Mars and Earth. There was a very simple reason for this. Their planet was cooling down internally and would become uninhabitable within 500 years. They thought, with good reason, that it was preferable to evacuate their people to a younger planet of the same category. What do you mean by the same category? I will explain later. To do so now would be premature. Going back to these people, I must tell you that these beings were human, very intelligent and highly evolved. A black race, they had thick lips, flattened noses and frizzy hair, resembling, in these ways, the blacks now living on Earth. These people had inhabited the planet Bacaratini for 8 million years, in cohabitation with a yellow-colored race. To be precise, this was what you call on Earth, the Chinese race, and they had inhabited Bacaratini for about 400 years prior to the blacks. The two races witnessed numerous revolutions during their time on the planet. We tried to provide relief, assistance and guidance but, in spite of our intervention, wars broke out periodically. These, along with the natural disasters occurring on the planet, served to thin the ranks in both races. Finally, a nuclear war broke out on such a grand scale that the entire planet was plunged into darkness and temperatures fell to minus 40 of your degrees Celsius. Not only did atomic radiation destroy the population, but cold and lack of food accomplished the rest. It is a recorded fact that a mere 150 black people and 85 yellow people survived the catastrophe, from a population of 7 billion black and 4 billion yellow humans. A register of survivors was taken just before they began to reproduce and when they had stopped killing each other. What do you mean, killing each other? Let me explain the whole situation to you and you'll be able to understand better. First of all, it is important to explain that those who remained were not, as you might expect, the leaders, well protected in specially equipped shelters. The survivors, comprising three groups of blacks and five groups of yellows, had come, some from private shelters and others from large public shelters. Of course, at the time of the war, there were many more than 235 people in shelters, Indeed, it is believed there were over 800,000 in all. Following months of confinement in the darkness and intense cold, they were eventually able to risk going outside. The blacks ventured out first, finding almost no trees, no plants, and no animals to speak of on their continent. It was a group, isolated from their shelter in the mountains, who first knew cannibalism. Because of the lack of food, when the weakest died, they were eaten. Then, in order to eat, they had to kill each other, and that was the worst catastrophe on their planet. Another group, near the ocean, managed to survive by eating the only living things left on the planet, which were not too contaminated, that is, the mollusks, some fish and crustaceans. They still had unpolluted drinking water thanks to very ingenious installations enabling them to obtain water from incredible depths. Of course, many of these people still died as a result of lethal radiation on the planet and from eating fish which were filled with radioactivity. Much the same course of events occurred in the Yellows' territory, so that, as I have said, 150 blacks and 85 yellows remained. Then finally, deaths resulting from the war ceased and reproduction began again. All of this occurred, in spite of all the warnings they had received. It should be said that before this almost total decimation, both the black race and the yellow race had attained a very high level of technological advance. The people lived in great comfort. They worked in factories, private and government enterprises, offices, just as happens now on your planet. They had a strong devotion to money which, to some, meant power and to others, wiser, it meant well-being. They worked on average 12 hours per week. On Bacaratini, a week comprises 6 days of 21 hours each. They tended to the material rather than the spiritual side of their existence. At the same time, they allowed themselves to be duped and led in circles by a structure of politicians and bureaucrats, exactly as is happening now on Earth. Leaders fool the masses with empty words and, motivated by greed or pride, they lead entire nations towards their downfall. Gradually, these two great races began to envy each other and, as there is only one step from envy to hate, eventually they hated each other so much and so completely that the catastrophe occurred. Both possessing very sophisticated arms, they achieved their mutual destruction. Our historical records show, then, that 235 survived the disaster, six of them being children. These statistics were recorded 5 years afterwards, and their survival is attributed to cannibalism and certain marine life. They reproduced, not always successfully, as it was not uncommon for babies to be born with horribly misshapen heads or ugly weeping sores. They had to endure all the effects of atomic radiation on human beings. 150 years later, there were 190,000 blacks, men, women and children, and 85,000 yellows. I speak to you of this 150-year period because this was when both races began to re-establish and when we were able to help them materially. What do you mean? Just a few hours ago, you saw our spacecraft stop above the planet Aramo X3 and take samples of soil, water and air, did you not? I nodded. Then, thou resumed, you watched as we quite easily annihilated a mass of giant ants as they attacked the inhabitants of a village. Indeed, in that particular case, we helped those people by intervening directly. You saw that they were living in a semi-wild state? Yes, but what happened on that planet? Atomic war, my friend. Always and eternally the same story. Don't forget, Michel, that the universe is a gigantic atom and everything is affected by that. Your body is composed of atoms. My point is, in all galaxies, each time a planet is inhabited, at a certain stage in its evolution, the atom is discovered or rediscovered. Of course, the scientists who discover it are very soon aware that the disintegration of the atom can be a formidable weapon, and, at one moment or another, the leaders want to use it. Just as a child with a box of matches is driven to set fire to a bale of straw in order to see what will happen. But coming back to the planet Bacaratini, 150 years after the nuclear holocaust, we wanted to help these people. Their immediate need was food. Still, they were subsisting essentially from products of the sea, resorting occasionally to cannibalism to satisfy their omnivorous yearnings. They needed vegetables and a source of meat. Vegetables, fruit trees, grains, animals, all that was edible had disappeared from the planet. There remained just enough inedible plants and bushes to replenish the oxygen in the atmosphere. At the same time, an insect, resembling in some ways your praying mantis, had survived and, as a result of spontaneous mutation caused by the atomic radiation, had evolved to gigantic proportions. It grew to about 8 meters in height and had become extremely dangerous to the people. In addition, this insect, having no natural predator, reproduced rapidly. We flew over the planet locating the whereabouts of these insects. This was a relatively easy task thanks to technology that has been at our disposal since time immemorial. When we detected the insects, we destroyed them so that, in a short time, we had exterminated them. Next, we had to reintroduce livestock, plants and trees on the planet according to the species known to have adapted climatically in specific regions before the catastrophe. This, too, was relatively easy. It must have taken years for such a task. A large smile lit up Thao's face. It took just 2 days, 2 21-hour days. Faced with my incredulity, Thao burst into laughter. She, or he, laughed so heartily that I joined in, still wondering, however, if the truth was being stretched somewhat. How could I know? What I was hearing was so fantastic. Perhaps I was hallucinating, perhaps I had been drugged, perhaps I would soon wake up in my very own bed. No, Michelle, interrupted Thao, reading my thoughts. I wish you would stop doubting in this way. Telepathy itself should be enough to convince you. As she uttered this sentence, it struck me that, even in the best planned hoax, it would hardly be possible to bring together so many supernatural elements. Thao was able to read my mind like an open book, and proved it over and over again. Latoli, simply by placing her hand on me, had produced such an extraordinary feeling of well-being, I must acknowledge the evidence. I was well and truly experiencing an extraordinary adventure. Perfect, Thao agreed aloud. May I continue? Please do, I encouraged. So, we helped these people materially. But, as so often when we intervene, we did not allow our presence to be known, and there are several reasons for that. The first is security. The second reason is a psychological one. If we had made these people aware of our existence and if they had realized we were there in order to help them, they would passively have allowed themselves to be helped and would have felt sorry for themselves. This would adversely affect their will to survive. As you say on Earth, God helps those who help themselves. The third and last reason is the main one. Universal law is well established and is as strictly enforced as that which controls the planet's revolutions around their suns. If you make a mistake, you pay the penalty, immediately, in 10 years' time, or in 10 centuries' time, but errors must be paid for. Thus, from time to time we are permitted, or even advised, to offer a helping hand, but we are formally forbidden to serve the meal on a plate. Thus, in 2 days, we repopulated their planet with several pairs of animals and re-established numerous plants so that eventually the people could raise the animals and cultivate the plants and trees. They had to start from scratch and we guided their progress, either by dream or telepathy. At times we did it by means of a voice coming from the heavens. That is to say, the voice came from our spacecraft, but to them, it came from heaven. They must have taken you to be gods. Exactly so, and it is in this way that legends and religions are established. But, in cases as urgent as that one was, the end justified the means. Finally, after several centuries, the planet was almost as it had been before the nuclear holocaust. All the same, in some places, deserts had been definitely established. In other spots less affected, the flora and fauna were easily developed. 150,000 years later, the civilization was highly successful, but, this time, not only technologically. Happily, the people had learned their lesson and had also evolved to a high psychic and spiritual level. This occurred in both races, and the blacks and the yellows had developed strong bonds of friendship. Thus, peace reigned on the planet, for the legends remained quite clear, many of them recorded in writing, so that future generations would know exactly what had provoked the nuclear catastrophe and what its consequences had been. As I said earlier, the people knew that their planet was going to become uninhabitable within 500 years. Knowing there were other planets, inhabited and inhabitable, in the galaxy, they mounted one of the most serious exploratory expeditions. Eventually, they penetrated your solar system, first visiting Mars, which was known to be inhabitable and which, at that time in fact, was inhabited. The human beings on Mars had no technology, but, by contrast, they were spiritually highly evolved. They were very small people, measuring in height between 120 centimeters and 150 centimeters, and of mongoloid type. They lived in tribes, in huts of stone. The fauna on Mars was scarce. There was a kind of dwarf goat, some very large hare-like creatures, several species of rat, and the largest animal resembled a buffalo but had a head like a tapir. There were also some birds and three species of snakes, one of which was quite venomous. The flora was also poor, trees attaining no more than 4 meters in height. They had, too, an edible grass that you might compare with buckwheat. The Bacaratinians conducted their research, realizing soon that Mars was also cooling down at a rate which indicated that it would no longer be inhabitable in 4 to 5,000 years. In terms of its flora and fauna, it was barely rich enough to sustain those already living there, let alone cope with an emigrant mass from Bacaratini. Besides, the planet did not appeal to them. Thus, the two spacecraft headed for Earth. The first landing took place where Australia is now found. At that time, it should be explained that Australia, New Guinea, Indonesia and Malaysia were all part of the one continent. A strait existed, about 300 kilometers wide, exactly where Thailand is now found. In those times, Australia possessed a great inland sea fed by several large rivers, so that diverse and interesting flora and fauna flourished there. All things considered, the astronauts chose this country as their first immigration base. I must say, to be more precise, that the black race chose Australia and the yellow people established themselves where Burma is now. Here too, was a land rich in wildlife. Bases were quickly set up on the coast, on the Bay of Bengal, while the black people constructed their first base on the shores of the inland sea in Australia. Later, further bases were established where New Guinea is presently located. Their spacecraft were capable of super light speeds and took approximately 50 of your Earth years to bring 3,600,000 black people and the same number of the yellow race to Earth. This bears witness to the perfect understanding and excellent association between two races determined to survive on a new planet and exist in peace. By common agreement, the aged and infirmed remained in Bacaratini. The Bacaratinians had explored all of the planet Earth before establishing their bases, and were absolutely persuaded that no human life existed before their arrival. Often they thought they had located a humanoid form of life, but on closer inspection, realized they had made contact with a species of large apes. Gravity on Earth was stronger than on their planet, and it was quite uncomfortable initially for the two races, but eventually they adapted very well. In building their towns and factories, they were fortunate to import from Bacaratini certain materials which were very light and, at the same time, very strong. I have not yet explained that, at that time, Australia was on the equator. Earth rotated on a different axis, taking 30 hours and 12 minutes to complete a rotation, and achieved a revolution around its sun in 280 such days. The equatorial climate was not as you will find it today. It was much more humid than now, for the Earth's atmosphere has changed. Herds of huge zebras roamed the country, in company with enormous edible birds, referred to as dodos, very large jaguars, and another bird measuring almost 4 meters in height, which you have called Dinornis. In certain rivers, there were crocodiles up to 15 meters in length and snakes 25 to 30 meters long. They, at times, nourished themselves on the new arrivals. Most of the flora and fauna on Earth was totally different from that on Bacaratini, both from a nutritional and ecological point of view. Numerous experimental farms were established in an endeavor to acclimatize plants such as sunflower, maize, wheat, sorghum, tapioca, and others. These plants either didn't exist on Earth or else existed in such a primitive state that they couldn't be consumed. The goat and the kangaroo were both imported, for the immigrants were quite partial to these, consuming them in great numbers on their planet. They were particularly keen to raise kangaroos on Earth, experiencing enormous difficulties, however, in acclimatizing them. One of the main problems was food. On Bacaratini, the kangaroo fed on a fine, hardy grass called arilu, which was totally unknown on Earth. Each time the Bacaratinians tried to grow it, it died, attacked always by millions of microscopic fungi. So it happened that the kangaroo were hand-fed, so to speak, for several decades, as they gradually adapted to the grasses on Earth. The black race persevered in its endeavors and finally succeeded in growing the plant, but it had taken so long that the kangaroos no longer required more than their new pastures. Very much later, some arilu plants took root and, as there were no animals to eat them, they spread throughout Australia. They still exist under the botanical name Xanthoria and the popular name, grass trees. On Earth, this grass grows much taller and thicker than it did on Bacaratini, but that often happens when species are introduced from other planets. This plant is one of the rare vestiges of those distant times. It indicates, by being found only in Australia, along with the kangaroo, that the Bacaratinians remained in that particular part of the planet for a very long time before seeking to colonize other parts. I am about to explain this, but I wanted first to cite the examples of the kangaroo and the Xanthoria so that you might better understand all the problems of adaptation these people had to overcome. Of course, it is only one small example among so many others. The yellow race had settled, as I said, in the hinterland of the Bay of Bengal. Most were in Burma, where they too had established cities and experimental farms. Principally interested in vegetables, they had imported from Bacaratini cabbages, lettuce, parsley, coriander, and some others. For fruit, they brought the cherry tree, the banana and the orange trees. These last two were difficult to establish, for the climate of the time was generally colder than it is now. Thus, they gave some of the trees to the blacks who, by contrast, had enormous success with them. In the same way, the yellow people had far greater success in the growing of wheat. In fact, the wheat from Bucaratini produced enormous grains, around the size of a coffee bean, with ears measuring up to 40 centimeters in length. Four varieties of wheat were grown and the yellow race wasted no time in establishing a very high production level. Did they also bring rice to the planet? No, not at all. Rice is a plant absolutely native to Earth, although it was greatly improved by the yellow people on its way to becoming what it is now. To continue, immense silos were constructed and soon, commercial exchanges began between the two races. The black race exported kangaroo meat, dodos, which were prolific at the time, and zebra meat. In domesticating the latter, the blacks in fact, produced breeds that were equal in taste to kangaroo meat and more nutritious. Trade was carried out using Bucaratini spacecraft, bases for these vessels having been set up all over the land. What you are saying, thou, is that the first men on earth were black and yellow. How is it then, that I come to be white? Not so fast, Michel, not so fast. The first men on earth were, indeed, the blacks and the yellows, but for the moment I will continue to explain how they organized themselves and how they lived. Materially, they were successful, but they were also careful not to neglect the construction of their immense meeting halls, in which they practiced their cult. They had a cult? Oh yes, they were all Tacchioni, which is to say, they all believed in reincarnation. Something in the way present-day Lamaists do on your planet. There was much travel between the two countries and they even combined efforts to explore deeper into certain regions of Earth. A mixed group of blacks and yellows landed one day on the tip of South Africa, now called the Cape of Good Hope. Africa has changed very little since those times, apart from the Sahara, the northeastern area and the Red Sea, which didn't exist then. But that is another story we will get to later. At the time of the exploration, they had already been established on Earth for 3 centuries. In Africa, they discovered new animals such as the elephant, the giraffe and the buffalo, and a new fruit that they had never before encountered, the tomato. Don't imagine, Michel, that this was the tomato as you know it today. When discovered, it was the size of a very small currant and very acidic. The yellow people, having developed great expertise in such things, undertook to improve the tomato over the succeeding centuries, just as they did with rice, until it became the fruit you are now familiar with. They were equally surprised to find banana trees that, at first sight, resembled those they had imported. They had no reason to regret their efforts, however, for the African banana was practically inedible and filled with large seeds. This African expedition comprised 50 blacks and 50 yellows, bringing home elephants, tomatoes and many mongoose, for they soon discovered the mongoose to be the mortal enemy of snakes. Unfortunately, they also brought with them without realizing it, the terrible virus which is now called yellow fever. In a very short time, millions of people had died, without their medical experts even knowing how the sickness had spread. Since it is mainly spread by the mosquito, and since there are many more mosquitoes in equatorial climates where there is no winter to reduce their numbers, it was the blacks in Australia who suffered most. In fact, they counted 4 times more victims than the yellows. The yellow race on Bucaratini has always been superior in the field of medicine and pathology. Nevertheless, it took many years before they discovered a remedy for this curse, during which time hundreds of thousands died in terrible suffering. Eventually, the yellow people produced a vaccine that was immediately made available to the blacks, a gesture that reinforced the bonds of friendship between the two races. What were they physically like, these blacks? When they migrated from Bacaratini, they were about 230 centimeters tall, their women too. They were a beautiful race. The yellow people were smaller in size, the average man measuring 190 centimeters and the women 180 centimeters. But you said that the present-day blacks are the descendants of those people. Why is it they are now so much smaller? Gravitation, Michel. Being stronger on Earth than on Bacaratini, both races gradually became smaller in size. You also said that you are able to help people in trouble. Why did you not give any assistance in regard to the yellow fever outbreak? Was it that you weren't able to find the vaccine either? We could have helped. You will realize our potential when you visit our planet, but we didn't intervene because it wasn't in the program that we had to follow. I have already told you, and I can't repeat it often enough, we can help in certain situations but only so far. Beyond a certain point, the law strictly forbids aid of any kind. I'll give you a simple example. Imagine a child who goes to school each day in order to learn. Returning home in the evening, this child asks for assistance with his homework. If his parents are smart, they will help him understand the concepts involved so that the child can complete his task himself. If, however, his parents did his work for him, he wouldn't learn much, would he? He'd have to repeat each year and his parents would have done him no favors. As you will see later, although you know it already, you are on your planet in order to learn how to live, suffer and die, but also to develop spiritually as much as you can. We'll come back to this point later when the Thaori speak to you. For now, I want to tell you more of these people. They overcame the curse of the yellow fever and spread their roots deeper on this new planet. Not only was Australia heavily populated, but so was the area now known as Antarctica. Of course, in those days, its position meant that its climate was temperate. New Guinea was also densely settled. By the end of the yellow fever scourge, the blacks numbered 795 million. I thought that Antarctica was not really a continent. At that time, it was attached to Australia and very much warmer than now, since Earth rotated on a different axis. The Antarctic climate was more like southern Russia is now. Did they never go back to Bacaratini? No. Once established on Earth, they made strict rules that no one would return. What became of their planet? It cooled down as predicted and became a desert, much like Mars. What was their political structure like? Very simple, election, by raised hands, of the leader of a village or district. These district leaders elected a town leader as well as 8 old people chosen from among those most respected for their wisdom, common sense, integrity and intelligence. They were never selected on the basis of wealth or family, and all were between 45 and 65 years of age. The town or regional leaders, a region comprised 8 villages, had the role of negotiating with the 8 old people. The Council of 8 elected, by a secret ballot requiring that at least 7 voted in accord, a delegate to represent them at meetings of state council. In Australia, for example, there were 8 states, each of which comprised 8 towns or regions. At state council meetings there were thus 8 delegates, each representing a different town or region. At a state council meeting, presided over by a great sage, they discussed the type of day-to-day problems that confront any government, water conveyance, hospitals, roads, etc. In regards to roads, both the black and the yellow races used very light vehicles, with a hydrogen motor, which traveled above the ground, thanks to a system based on anti-magnetic and anti-gravitational force. But to get back to the political system, there was no such thing as a party, everything being based solely on reputation for integrity and wisdom. Long experience had taught them that to establish an order that would endure, required two golden ingredients, fairness and discipline. I will speak to you some other time of their economic and social organization, and give you an idea now of their system of justice. A thief, for example, genuinely considered to be guilty, was branded with a red-hot iron on the back of the hand he or she ordinarily used. So, a right-handed thief was branded on the right hand, a subsequent offense resulted in the left hand being cut off. This is a practice that still occurred quite recently among the Arabs, a practice conserved throughout time past. If he or she continued to steal, the right hand would be cut off and the forehead marked with an indelible symbol. Without hands, the thief was at the mercy and pity of his family and passers-by for food, for everything. Because people would recognize the symbol as that of a thief, life became very difficult. Death would have been preferable. In this way, the thief became a living example of what happened to a habitual offender. Needless to say, theft was a rare occurrence. As for murder, this too was rare, as you will see. Accused murderers were taken to a special room and left alone. Behind a curtain, a mind reader would be installed. This was a man who not only possessed a special telepathic gift but who also cultivated that gift in a constant endeavor, in one or another of the special universities. He would intercept the thoughts of the supposed murderer. You are going to retort that it is possible, with training, to make one's mind blank, but not for 6 hours at a stretch. Further, at various times when he or she might least expect it, certain predetermined sounds would be heard, obliging the subject to break concentration. As a precautionary measure, 6 different mind readers were used. The same procedure was applied to witnesses for the prosecution or defense, in another building some distance away. Not a word would be exchanged and, on the 2 following days, the procedure would be repeated, this time for 8 hours. On the 4th day, all the mind readers submitted their notes to a panel of 3 judges, who interviewed and cross-examined the accused and the witnesses. There were no lawyers or juries to impress. The judges had before them all the particulars of the case, and wanted to be absolutely sure of the guilt of the accused. Why? The penalty was death, Michel, but a terrible death, the murderer being thrown alive to the crocodiles. As for rape, which was considered worse than murder, the punishment was even crueler. The offender was coated with honey and buried to the shoulders in the immediate vicinity of an ant colony. Death, at times, would take 10 or 12 hours. As you will now understand, the crime rate was extremely low among both races and, for this reason, they had no need for prisons. Don't you consider that excessively cruel? Consider the mother of a 16-year-old girl, for example, who was raped and murdered. Doesn't she endure, in the loss of her child, cruelty of the worst kind? She did not provoke or seek her loss, but she must suffer. The criminal, on the other hand, is aware of the consequences of his actions, thus, it is just that he be punished very cruelly. As I have explained, however, criminality was almost non-existent. Returning to religion, I said earlier that both races believed in reincarnation, but there were variations on their beliefs that, at times, divided them. Certain priests diverted masses of people to group them, under their leadership, in these variant religions. The divisions that resulted among the blacks had disastrous repercussions. Eventually, about 500,000 blacks emigrated in the wake of their priests to Africa, to the area where the Red Sea is now. At that time, the Red Sea did not exist and the land was African. They began to construct villages and towns, but the political system as I described to you, which was fair and effective in all respects, was abandoned. The priests themselves elected the heads of government, so that these leaders became, more or less, puppets manipulated by the priests. From that time on, the people had to face many of the problems that are so familiar to you on Earth at the present time: corruption, prostitution, drugs, and all manner of injustices. As for the yellow people, they were very well structured and, in spite of some slight religious distortions, their priests had no say in the affairs of state. They lived in peace and affluence, quite different from the secessionist black race in Africa. And in regard to arms, what sorts of weapons did they have? It was quite simple and, as simplicity is often superior to complexity, it worked wonderfully well. Both races brought with them what we could call laser weapons. These weapons were under the control of a special group which, in turn, was under the direction of the leaders of each country. By common accord, each race had exchanged 100 observers whose presence was permanent in each foreign country. These observers were ambassadors and diplomats for their own countries, at the same time, ensuring that an arms excess did not occur. This system worked perfectly and peace was maintained for 3,550 years. The blacks who emigrated to Africa, however, had not been allowed to take these weapons with them, being, as they were, a secessionist group. Little by little they spread further, settling the area that is now the Sahara Desert. In those times, it was a rich land with a temperate climate, providing a well-vegetated habitat for many animals. The priests had temples constructed and, to satisfy their desire for wealth and power, they taxed the people heavily. Among a people who had never before known poverty, there now formed two distinct classes, the very rich and the very poor. The priests, of course, belonged to the former, as did those who helped them to exploit the poor. Religion became idolatry and the people worshipped stone or wooden gods, offering sacrifices to them. It was not long before the priests insisted that the sacrifices must be human. From the beginning of the secession, the priests took pains to ensure that the people were kept in ignorance to the greatest extent possible. By lowering their intellectual and physical level of development over the course of years, the priests were better able to maintain domination over them. The religion which had developed had absolutely nothing in common with the cult that had originally inspired the secession, so control of the masses was essential. Universal law decrees that man's principal obligation, regardless of which planet he happens to inhabit, is to develop his spirituality. These priests, by degrading an entire nation, through keeping them in ignorance and leading them with lies, infringed this fundamental law. We decided at this point to intervene, but, before doing so, offered the priests a last chance. Using telepathy, as well as a dream, we contacted the great priest. Human sacrifices must cease and these people must be led back to the right path. Man exists physically for the sole purpose of developing spiritually. What you are doing contravenes universal law. The great priest was terribly shaken and, the next day, called a meeting of his priests, telling them of his dream. A few among them accused him of betrayal. Others suggested senility, and some suspected hallucinations. Eventually, following several hours of discussion, 12 of the 15 priests who formed this council remained determined to preserve the religion as it was, claiming that the ideal was to maintain control and to promote the belief in and fear of vengeful gods, whose representatives they were on earth. They didn't believe a word of what the great priest had told them regarding his dream. Sometimes our position is very delicate, Michel. We could have appeared with our spacecraft and spoken directly to the priests, but they were able to identify vessels from space, having had them too, before the secession. They would have attacked us immediately, no questions asked, for they were very suspicious and fearful of losing their preeminence within their nation. They had formed an army and possessed quite powerful weapons to be used to counter possible revolutions. We could also have destroyed them and spoken directly to the people in order to lead them back to the right path, but, psychologically, this would have been a mistake. These people were accustomed to obeying their priests and would not have understood why we interfered in the affairs of their country, thus all would have been spoiled. So it was that one night we flew above the country at an altitude of 10,000 meters in one of our tool spheres. The temple and the holy city were situated about 1 kilometer from the town. We woke, by telepathy, the great priest and the 2 acolytes who had followed his advice, making them go, on foot, to a beautiful park, 1.5 kilometers from the holy city. Then, by collective hallucination, we had the guards open the jails and release the prisoners. Servants, soldiers, in fact, all the inhabitants of the holy city, with the exception of the 12 evil priests, were evacuated. Inspired by strange visions, in the sky, everyone ran for the other end of the town. In the sky, winged personages hovered around an enormous incandescent cloud which shone in the night. How is that done? Collective illusion, Michel. Thus, in a very short time, it was arranged that only the 12 evil priests remained in the holy city. When all was ready, the tool sphere destroyed it all, including the temple, by means of the same weapon that you have already seen in action. Rocks were shattered and walls crumbled to a height of 1 meter, that their ruins might bear witness to the consequence of this sin. Indeed, if they had been totally effaced, men would soon have forgotten, for men easily forget. Further, and for the edification of the people, a voice issuing from the incandescent cloud warned that the anger of God could be terrible, much worse than they had seen, and that they must obey the great priest and follow the new way which he would show them. When it was all over, the great priest stood before the people and spoke to them. He explained to the poor wretches that he had been wrong, and that it was now important that everyone strive together to follow the new way. He was assisted in his work by the 2 priests. Of course, times were often hard, but they were aided by the memory and the fear of the event that had destroyed, in a matter of minutes, the holy city and killed the evil priests. Needless to say, this event was considered by all to be a miracle of the gods, for it also involved the liberation of more than 200 prisoners who were to face human sacrifice the next day. All the details of the incident were noted by the scribes, but they were also distorted in the legends and tales passed on through the centuries. Nevertheless, the immediate consequence was that everything changed. The rich who had previously had a hand in the exploitation of the people, now, in view of what had happened to the evil priests and the holy city, were fearful of meeting a similar fate. They were considerably humbled and assisted the new leaders in instigating the changes required. Gradually, the people became contented again, as they had been in times prior to the secession. Inclined towards pastoral rather than industrial or urban pursuits, they spread throughout Africa during the course of the centuries that followed and numbered, eventually, several million. Nevertheless, towns were only established in the area where the Red Sea is now, and along the banks of a large river that flowed through the center of Africa. The people managed to develop their psychic abilities enormously. Many were able to travel short distances by means of levitation, and telepathy resumed its significance in their lives, becoming commonplace. There were also frequent instances of physical ailments being cured by the laying on of hands. Amicable relations were re-established with the black people in Australia and New Guinea, who came to visit them regularly on chariots of fire, as they sometimes called the spaceships still being used by their Australian brothers. The yellow race, being closer neighbors, began to immigrate, in small numbers, to northern Africa, and were fascinated by the tales of the arrival of God on a chariot of fire. This is how the legends subsequently referred to our intervention. The yellow people were the first to mix with the black race, physically speaking, I mean. It might be surprising, but never, on Bacaratini, had the race mixed to the extent that they did on Earth. The ethnologists were greatly interested in the results of this union, which produced on Earth a great new tribe. Indeed, these crossbreeds, as I'll call them, being crossed with more yellow blood than black, ended up feeling more at ease among themselves than with either black or yellow. Eventually, they grouped together and settled in the area now called Algeria, Tunisia, North Africa. Thus, a new race was born, the Arab race that you know. Don't think, though, they immediately resembled the race they are now. Climate and time, the passing of centuries, had its effect. My story simply gives you the idea of how the race began through interbreeding. And so, all was going well for the inhabitants of the planet Earth, except for one thing. The astronomers and scholars were very worried, for an enormous asteroid was approaching Earth, almost imperceptibly, but unmistakably. It was first picked up by the observatory of Ikarito, located in the center of Australia. After several months, it could be seen by the naked eye, provided one knew where to look, glowing a most sinister, vivid red. In the weeks to follow, it became ever more readily visible. The governments of Australia, New Guinea, and Antarctica made a most important decision, which was soon agreed to by the yellow leaders. Ahead of the inevitable collision with the asteroid, they agreed that all space vessels in a condition to fly would leave Earth, carrying on board as many specialists and experts as possible, doctors, technicians, etc., of the kind most likely to be of service to the community following the catastrophe. Where were they going? To the moon? No, Michel, at that time Earth didn't have a moon. Their spacecraft were now capable of 12 weeks autonomous flight. For a long time, their capability for super long distance travel had been lost to them. Their plan was to remain in orbit around the Earth, ready to land as soon as possible and give assistance where it was most needed. 80 Australian spacecraft were equipped and loaded to carry an elite group, which was chosen as a result of meetings held day and night. The yellow race followed the same procedure, making 98 spacecraft ready. In Africa, of course, there had never been any spaceships. I ask you to note, in passing, that apart from the supreme leader of each country, none of his ministers, as you might call them, was given a place on any vessel. This will probably seem odd to you, for if the same situation were to occur today on Earth, many politicians would be pulling strings to save their own skins. All was ready. The people were then warned of the impending collision. The role of the spacecraft was kept secret, though, for fear that the people would believe they had been betrayed by their leaders and that a panic would be created, perhaps even an attack on the airports. By the same token, the leaders had played down the impact the collision was likely to have, in order to minimize the collective panic. The collision was now as much imminent as it was inevitable, considering the estimated speed of the asteroid. It was only 48 hours away. The experts all agreed with this calculation, well, almost all. The spaceships were to take off together 2 hours before the supposed collision time, their very late departure intended to allow them to remain in space for the full 12 weeks if necessary, following the catastrophe. It had been calculated that the asteroid would hit where South America is now. So, all was ready and the signal for takeoff to be given on D-Day, at 12 noon, Central Australian time. Whether there had been an error in the calculations, although highly unlikely, or whether there was a sudden, unpredicted acceleration of the asteroid, it appeared in the sky at 11 a.m., shining like an orange sun. The order for takeoff was given immediately and all the spacecraft took to the sky. In order to leave Earth's atmosphere and gravitational force quickly, it is necessary to make use of a warp, which at that time was above present-day Europe. In spite of the speed these space vessels were capable of, they had not quite made it to the warp when the asteroid hit Earth. When it entered the Earth's atmosphere, it had broken into three huge pieces. The smallest, which measured several kilometers in diameter, hit where the Red Sea is now. Another, much bigger, hit where the Timor Sea is now, and the largest of the three landed in the region of the actual Galapagos Islands. The simultaneous impacts were terrible. The sun became a dull red and slid towards the horizon like a falling balloon. Soon, it stopped and climbed slowly, but when only to half the distance, it fell. The Earth had suddenly changed the inclination of its axis. Explosions of incredible force occurred, for two larger pieces of asteroid had pierced the Earth's crust. Volcanoes erupted in Australia, New Guinea, Japan, South America, indeed, just about everywhere on the planet. Mountains formed instantly and tidal waves more than 300 meters in height swept over four-fifths of Australia. Tasmania separated from the Australian continent and a huge portion of Antarctica sank in the waters, creating two immense underwater canyons between Antarctica and Australia. An enormous continent rose from the waters in the center of the South Pacific Ocean. A huge piece of Burma subsided where the Bay of Bengal is now. Another basin of land subsided and the Red Sea was formed. Was there time for the spaceships to get out? Not quite, Michel, for the experts had made one mistake. It could be said in their defense that they could not really have anticipated what would happen. They had predicted the tilting of the Earth on its axis, but what they hadn't been able to predict was its oscillation. The spacecraft were literally caught and dragged in the backwash, caused by the re-entry of the asteroid into the Earth's atmosphere. Further, they were bombarded by millions of particles coming from the asteroid and trailing in its wake. Only seven vessels, three with black passengers and four with yellow, struggling with all the power they could manage, succeeded in escaping the horror occurring on Earth. It must have been a frightening sight for them to watch Earth change before their eyes. How long did it take for the continent you mentioned in the Pacific Ocean to emerge? Merely a matter of hours. This continent was raised by gaseous belts resulting from upheavals occurring as deep as the center of the planet. The upheavals on the Earth's surface continued for months. In the three points of impact of the asteroids, thousands of volcanoes were created. Poisonous gases spread over most of the Australian continent, causing painless death within minutes of millions of blacks. Our statistics indicate an almost total annihilation of humankind and of animals in Australia. A count taken when calm was restored indicated a mere 180 people had survived. The poisonous gases were the cause of this frightful toll. In New Guinea, where less gas had drifted, there were fewer deaths. I have been wanting to ask you a question, Val. Please do. You said that it was the black people from Australia who spread to New Guinea and Africa. How is it then that now the Aborigines are so different from the blacks throughout the world? Excellent question, Michelle. My account should have included more detail. You see, as a result of the catastrophe, there had been such an upheaval that deposits of uranium scattered on the surface of the earth emitted strong radiation. This happened only in Australia, and those who escaped death were badly affected, just as in an atomic explosion. They were genetically affected, so that today, the genes of Africans are different from those of Aborigines. Further, the environment totally changed and their diet drastically altered too. With the progress of time, these descendants of Bacaratinians were transformed into the aboriginal race of today. As the upheavals continued, mountains were formed, some suddenly, others within days. Crevasses opened, swallowing entire towns, and then closing, removing all traces of existing civilization. On top of all the horror, there was a deluge such as the planet had not known for eons. In fact, the volcanoes spat so many ashes into the sky simultaneously, and to such incredible altitudes, that the sky darkened. The vapor from the oceans, which in places actually boiled over an area of thousands of square kilometers, combined with the clouds of ashes. The thick clouds thus created burst with rain so torrential you'd find it hard to imagine. And the vessels orbiting in space? After 12 weeks, they were obliged to return to Earth. They chose to descend over the area we now know as Europe, having absolutely no visibility over the rest of the planet. Of the 7 vessels, only one managed to land. The others were hurled into the ground by gales, which occurred all over the planet. Cyclonic winds of 300 to 400 kilometers per hour. The main cause of these winds was differences in temperature, these in turn, caused by the sudden volcanic eruptions. So, the sole remaining spaceship managed to land in what is now called Greenland. There were 95 yellow passengers on board, many of whom were doctors and experts of various kinds. Having landed in extremely adverse conditions, damage was incurred which made it impossible for the vessel to take off again. However, it remained useful for a shelter. They had provisions enough to last a long time, and so they organized themselves as best they could. About 1 month later, they were all engulfed in an earthquake, the spacecraft too, and it was with this last catastrophe that all trace of civilization on Earth was destroyed. The chain of catastrophes that followed the collision with the asteroid had dispersed entire populations in New Guinea, Burma, and China. And in Africa, although the region of the Sahara suffered to a lesser extent than elsewhere. However, all the towns established in the Red Sea area were engulfed by the newly formed sea. In brief, no city remained on Earth and millions of people and animals had been wiped out. It was, therefore, not long before widespread famine occurred. Needless to say, the wonderful cultures of Australia and China were no more than memories that would become legends. And so it was that the people suddenly disseminated and separated from each other by newly gouged chasms and newly formed seas, experienced for the first time on the planet Earth, cannibalism.
This is part 4 of the Golden Planet.
The Golden Planet. As Thal was winding up her narrative, my attention was drawn to lights of different colors, which had lit up near her seat. When she had finished talking, she made a gesture. On one of the walls of the room, there appeared a series of letters and numbers, which Thal examined attentively. Then the light went out and the image disappeared. "Thou," I said, "you spoke just now of hallucination or collective illusion. I have trouble understanding how you can delude thousands of people. Isn't it charlatanism, just as when an illusionist on stage fools the crowd with a dozen, more or less chosen, subjects? Thou smiled again. You are right in a certain sense, for it is extremely rare these days on your planet and especially on stage to find a true illusionist. I must remind you that we are experts in all manner of psychic phenomena, Michel, and for us it is quite easy because... At that moment, a shock of extraordinary violence shook the spacecraft. Thou looked at me with horrified eyes. Her whole face had completely changed and one could read in it sheer terror. With a dreadful cracking sound, the vessel split into several pieces and I heard screams from astronauts, as we were all hurled into space. Thou had grabbed hold of my arm and we were flung through the sidereal emptiness at a giddying speed. I realized, only because of the speed we were traveling, that we were about to cross paths with a comet, exactly like the one we had passed by several hours earlier. I felt Thou's hand on my arm but didn't even think to turn my head in her direction. I was literally mesmerized by the comet. We were going to collide with its tail, that was certain, and already I could feel the terrible heat. The skin on my face was ready to burst. It was the end. "Are you okay, Michel?" asked Thou gently from her seat. I thought I was going mad. I was sitting opposite her in the same seat where I had listened to her account of the first man on Earth. "Are we dead or mad?" I asked. "Neither, Michel. There is a saying on your planet that a picture is worth a thousand words. You asked me how we were able to delude crowds of people. I replied immediately by creating an illusion for you. I realize I should have chosen a less frightening experience, but the subject is a very important one in this case. It's fantastic. I never would have believed that it could happen like that, and so suddenly. It was so very real, the whole scenario. I don't know what to say. The only thing I ask of you is not to frighten me like that again. Besides, I could die of fright. Not at all. Our physical bodies were in our seats and we simply separated our, let's call them, astropsychic bodies from our physical ones and from our other bodies. What other bodies? All the others. The physiological, the psychotypical, the astral, and so on. Your astropsychic body was separated from the others by a telepathic system originating in my brain which acts in this case like a transmitter. A direct correlation is established between my astropsychic body and yours. All that I imagined was projected in your astropsychic body exactly as if it was happening. The only thing is, not having had time to prepare you for the experience, I had to be very cautious. What do you mean? Well, when you create an illusion, the subject, or subjects, should be prepared to see what you want them to see. For example, if you want people to see a spaceship in the sky, it is important that they are expecting to see one. If they expect to see an elephant, they will never see the spaceship. Thus, with the right words and cleverly controlled suggestions, the crowd will unite around you in anticipation of seeing a spaceship, a white elephant, or the Virgin of Fatima, a typical case of the phenomenon on Earth. It would have to be easier with a single subject than with 10,000. Not at all. On the contrary, with several people, a chain reaction is produced. You release the astropsychic bodies of the individuals and when you put the procedure in motion, they telepathize among themselves. It's a bit like the famous domino lines, when you make the first one fall, all the others must fall right down to the last one. So it was a very easy game with you. Since you left Earth, you have remained more or less anxious. You don't know what will logically happen next. I took advantage of this typical case of conscious or unconscious fear that is always present when one travels in a flying machine, the fear of exploding or crashing. Then, as you had seen the comet on the screen, why not use it too? Rather than cook your face as you approached the comet, I could have made you cross the tail believing it to be frozen. In all, you could have driven me insane. Not in such a short time. But that had to have lasted more than 5 minutes. No more than 10 seconds, just as in a dream, or should I say a nightmare, which occurs, by the way, in approximately the same manner. For example, you are sleeping and you begin to dream. You are in a field with a wonderful white stallion. You approach to catch him, but each time you try, he runs away. After 5 or 6 attempts, which take time of course, you leap on the horse's back and begin to gallop and gallop. Faster and faster you go, and you are happily intoxicated by the speed. The stallion gallops so fast that he no longer touches the ground. He is airborne, and the countryside passes beneath you, river, plains, and forests. It is truly wonderful. Then a mountain appears on the horizon, looming taller and taller as you approach. You have to rise higher with difficulty. The horse flies up and up. It is almost over the highest peak when his shoe strikes a rock, unbalancing you, so that you fall, down and down. You go into a chasm that seems to have no end, and you find you have fallen out of bed onto the floor. No doubt you are going to tell me this dream lasts only a few minutes. It would have lasted 4 seconds. The dream started as though, from a certain point, you wound back a film on video and then watched it. I know it is difficult to comprehend, but in this particular dream, all would have begun at the moment you lost your balance in bed. I confess that I don't understand. I'm not at all surprised, Michelle. To understand completely requires much more study in the field, and, on Earth at the present time, you don't have anyone capable of instructing you on the subject. Dreams don't really matter for the moment, Michelle, but without your realizing it, during the few hours you have spent with us, you have made great progress in certain areas, and this is what matters. Now it is time to explain to you our motives for bringing you to Theuba. We are entrusting you with a mission. This mission is to report all that you are going to see, live and hear during your time with us. Report everything in one or several books that you will write when you return to Earth. We have been observing the behavior of the people on your planet for thousands and thousands of years, as you now realize. A certain percentage of these people are arriving at a very critical point in history, and we feel that the time has come to try to assist them. If they will listen, we can ensure that they take the right path. This is why you have been chosen. But I am not a writer. Why haven't you chosen a good writer, someone well known, or a good journalist? Thou smiled at my vehement reaction. The only writers who might have done it, as it must be done, are dead, I mean Plato or Victor Hugo. And they still would have reported the facts with too much stylistic embellishment. We require the most precise account possible. Then you need a journalist reporter. Michelle, you know yourself that journalists on your planet are so inclined towards sensationalism that they often distort the truth. How often, for example, do you see news reports that differ from channel to channel or paper to paper? Whom do you believe when one gives the death toll in an earthquake as 75, another as 62, and another as 95? Do you really imagine we would trust a journalist? You're absolutely right, I exclaimed. We have observed you and we know all about you as we know about some others on Earth. And you were selected. But why exactly me? I am not the only one on Earth capable of objectivity. Why not you? In time, you will learn the principal reason behind our choice. I didn't know what to say. Moreover, my objections were ridiculous since I had already embarked on this affair and there was no going back. Ultimately, I had to admit I was enjoying this space voyage more and more. Certainly, millions of human beings would have given all they owned to be in my place. I will argue no further though. If this is your decision, I can only yield to it. I hope I will be equal to the task. Have you considered that 99% of people will not believe a word of what I say? For most people, it will be too incredible. Michel, almost 2,000 years ago, did they believe that Christ was sent by God as he claimed? Certainly not, for they wouldn't have crucified him had they believed. Now, however, there are millions who believe what he said. Who believes him? Do they really believe him thou? And who was he anyway? First of all, who is God? Does he exist? I have been expecting this question, and it is important that you ask it. On an ancient stone tablet, which I believe is Nikkal, it is written, "In the beginning there was nothing, all was darkness and silence. The Spirit, the superior intelligence, decided to create the worlds, and he commanded to four superior forces." It's extremely difficult for the human mind, even when highly developed, to comprehend such a thing. In fact, in a sense, it is impossible. On the other hand, your astral spirit assimilates it when it is freed from your physical body. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's go back to the very beginning. In the beginning, there was nothing except darkness and a spirit, the Spirit. The Spirit was, and is, infinitely powerful, powerful beyond the comprehension of any human mind. The Spirit is so powerful that he was able, by the action of his will alone, to trigger an atomic explosion with chain reactions of unimaginable force. In fact, the Spirit imagined the worlds, he imagined how to create them, from the most enormous to the most minuscule. He imagined the atoms. When he imagined them, he created, in his imagination, all that moved and will move, all that lived and will live, all that is motionless, or seems to be, every single thing. But it existed only in his imagination. All was still in darkness. Once he had an overall view of what he wanted to create, he was able, by his exceptional spiritual force, to create, instantaneously, the four forces of the universe. With these, he directed the first and the most gigantic atomic explosion of all time, what certain people on Earth call the Big Bang. The Spirit was at its center and induced it. Darkness was gone and the universe was creating itself according to the will of the Spirit. The Spirit was thus, is still, and always will be, at the center of the universe, for he is the master and creator of it. Well then, I interrupted, it's the story of God as the Christian religion teaches it, or just about, and I never believed in their nonsense. Michel, I speak of no religion such as exists on earth, and especially not the Christian religion. Don't confuse religions with the creation and the simplicity of all that ensued. Don't confuse logic with the illogical distortions of religions. We will have the opportunity to talk again later on this subject, and you are certainly in for some surprises. For the moment, I was trying to explain the creation to you. During billions of years, for the Creator of course, it is eternally the present. But it is more at the level of our understanding to count by billions of years, all the worlds, suns and atoms were formed, as you are taught in schools, the planets revolving around their suns, and sometimes with their own satellites, etc. At certain times in certain solar systems, some planets cool down, soil is formed, rocks solidify, oceans are formed and landmasses become continents. Finally, these planets become habitable for certain forms of life. All this was in the beginning, in the imagination of the Spirit. We can call his first force the atomic force. At this stage, by his second force, he conceived the primary living creatures and many of the primary plants, from which later derived the subspecies. This second force we will call the ovocosmic force, as these creatures and plants were created by simple cosmic rays, which ended up with cosmic eggs. At the very beginning, the spirit imagined experiencing feelings through a special creature. He had imagined man by means of the third force that we will call the ovoastromic force. Thus man was created. Have you ever considered, Michel, what intelligence it took to create a human being or even an animal? Blood that circulates thanks to the heart that beats millions of times independently of the will. Lungs that purify the blood by means of a complex system. The nervous system. The brain which gives the orders, aided by the five senses. The spinal cord which is ultra-sensitive and which will make you, instantly, withdraw your hand from a hot stove so you won't burn yourself. It would have taken 1/10 of a second for the brain to issue the order to prevent your hand from being burnt. Have you ever wondered why, that of the billions of individuals on a planet like yours, there are no two fingerprints the same, and why, what we call the crystalline of the blood is just as unique among individuals as the fingerprint? Your experts and technicians on Earth and on other planets have tried and still try to create a human body. Have they succeeded? In regards to the robots they have made, not even the most highly perfected will ever be more than a vulgar machine in comparison with the human mechanism. To go back to the crystalline I mentioned just now, it is best described as a certain vibration particular to the blood of each individual. It has nothing to do with the blood group. Various religious sects on Earth believe absolutely in the rightness of refusing blood transfusions. Their reasons relate to the teachings and books of their religious teachings and their own interpretations of these, whereas they should look to the real reason, which is the impact the different vibrations have on each other. If it is a large transfusion, it can have an influence on the recipient to a degree and, for a length of time, which varies according to the volume of the transfusion. This influence, of course, is never dangerous. After a time, which never exceeds 1 month, the vibrations of the recipient's blood takes over, leaving no trace of the vibrations of the donor's blood. It shouldn't be forgotten that these vibrations are much more a feature of the physiological and fluidic body than that of the physical body. But I notice that I have deviated greatly from my subject, Michel. In any case, it is time now to rejoin the others. We are not far from arriving at Theuba. I didn't dare ask Thou then about the nature of the fourth force, for already she was heading for the exit. I left my seat and followed her back to the command post. There, on the panel and in close-up view, a person was talking slowly and almost continuously. Numbers and figures, with luminous dots of different bright colors, were continually crossing the screen, interspersed with symbols. Thou sat me down in the seat I had previously occupied and asked me not to interfere with my security system. She then moved away to confer with Biostra, who seemed to be supervising the astronauts, each of whom was busy at her respective desk. Finally, she came back and sat down in the seat next to mine. "What is happening?" I asked. "We are reducing speed progressively as we approach our planet. We are now 848 million kilometers away and will arrive in about 25 minutes. Can we see it now?" "Patience, Michel. 25 minutes is not the end of the world." She winked, evidently in good humor. The close-up view on the panel was replaced by a wide-angle shot, allowing us a general view of the command room of the intergalactic base, as we had seen earlier. Now each operator was deep in concentration at her particular desk. Many of the desk computers were operated orally, rather than manually, responding to the operators' voices. Figures, accompanied by luminous dots of various colors, crossed the screen rapidly. No one in the spacecraft remained standing. Suddenly, there it was, right in the middle of the panel. The intergalactic center had been replaced by Theuba. My guess had to be correct, I could feel it. Thou immediately telepathized an affirmative, leaving me in no doubt. As we approached and Theuba grew on the panel, I couldn't take my eyes off the sight, for what I saw before me was indescribably beautiful.
End of part four, and the saga continues next week.
I am Barry, it's been the voice within. Kakite, shalom, namaste, masalam. May your God go with you.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.